Welcome to The Lorraine Murphy Show. I'm an entrepreneur on my second business, a mentor, an author, wife to a fellow entrepreneur, and mother to a magical little girl. On my podcast, I explore topics that fascinate me that will help you unlock ideas to rise even higher in your life. Myself and my special guests will be talking entrepreneurship and how to build better businesses, organization and figuring out how to get more shit done quicker and smarter, staying in touch with our soul, and how to blend business babies with real babies. Let's jump in to this week's episode. Welcome to this week's episode of The Lorraine Murphy Show. As always, it is an absolute delight to have you joining me. So, in case you're catching up, this season is all about chicken soup conversations. So, deep and meaningful chats with those who've seen me through some big chapters in my life and with whom I've built a rich tapestry of shared experience with, aka they're my anchors. My intent with this season is to welcome you into our conversation each week as we share memories, funny stories and life lessons together, and no doubt give you a much more rounded perspective on who I am. So, moving on to this week's chicken soup conversation, which is one with one of my closest friends, Julie Masters, a two-time entrepreneur, speaker, podcaster, and mama of two. Julie just radiates certainty, confidence, and love, and she's definitely the kind of person you want to have around you in a crisis. I have such deep respect for her and how she places the boundaries that she places in place around her, the deep thinker that she is, and the ridiculously powerful wisdom she possesses. In this chat, we speak about how we came to meet and have a mutual business girl crush on each other, how her plan to sit on a mountain surrounded by llamas in Peru morphed into her co-founding her first business back in Sydney, the almost freakish way our lives have mirrored each other, her painful experience of adrenal fatigue and how she found her way through it, what a first phone call friend is, and she is definitely that for me once she explained it to me, the fertility challenges that she and her husband experience and the IVF journey they've been on and what that experience taught her, not just about fertility, but life overall. Her belief that sometimes the very best thing we can do with the problem is to let it burn. The greatest thing we each value about our friendship. The nugget of wisdom that helps her keep perspective on having meltdowns in front of her kids. This is extremely helpful to any of us who are spending a lot more time with our families right now. And how she is coping with ISO life, as I call it. So let's kick in to myself and Julie's chicken soup conversation. Okay, so we've already been talking for half an hour before I realized we should probably start recording. This is my beautiful friend, Julie Masters. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in my spare room.
Yeah, we were just comparing notes on where we're working. You're in your spare room.
And I'm in my spare room.
Dining table up to the spare room so you can work up there.
Yep, I've got lipstick next to me just in case anyone surprises me, or lip balm next to me, tinted lip balm next to me, and a pair of earplugs.
Nice.
And that is my life right now.
And I'm sitting on the floor of Lexi's bedroom, sitting on her little fluffy doggy seat, which is actually my usual podcast spot. So yes, all the glamour of podcasting life right now, clearly. And so, hon, I'm absolutely delighted to have you. I'm actually sorry we weren't recording that 30-minute conversation, because I think with you, and something I just cherish so much about our friendship, is we just dive deep. There's very little, if any, small talk. You know, we've just, in 30 minutes, covered our relationships with our husbands, working from home. We just brainstormed some ideas for each other's businesses. It's a friendship that I absolutely love being in, and I'm very grateful to have it. So thank you for being happy to share more of you with my audience. I know they're going to get so much out of this chat already.
You're welcome. And actually, you know, it's funny. That is something I keep learning over and over again. Press record from the beginning. Even if you edit it out, press record from the beginning. Because with my podcast, the thing, you know, you always have these beautiful conversations up front where everybody's relaxed and, you know, you're not in mode yet. And then at the end, I always think, oh, if I'd have had that, that was the best bit.
Oh, no, I wish. I mean, I know we'll recreate it, but yeah, you just make me think, which is one of my questions for further on in this chat. So, my dear, obviously the first time you were on the podcast, it was very much with your professional hat on. So you were talking about how to build your influence and talking about the fact that you know, personal brand isn't something that you necessarily subscribe to. And it was an incredible conversation. But what I found really interesting is that regardless of the people who listened to that, whether they had their own businesses or were professionals or weren't, I think some of the biggest gold that you had to share in that chat was just how you organize your life and your reflections on being a working mother. So I think at the time you were pregnant with Ethan then, weren't you?
I think I was.
Yeah, you were still a mom of one at that point, and now you've obviously got Tally and Ethan and Tally. So today will be, given that this is chicken soup conversations, given the crazy world that we're all living in right now, our conversation's going to be broader, and I know you're really excited to get into that as well.
Let's do it.
Okay, so can you give us a bit of an overview of your life to date? This is almost like in a job interview. Tell us a bit about yourself, because obviously I know you, and I'm sure there's lots that I'm still going to learn about you in this conversation. Just give us a bit of an overview to you to start with.
How far back do you want me to go?
Well, obviously from the UK. Maybe talk about what you were doing in the UK and why you moved to Australia.
Okay, so I started out in the UK, just living in a little small village. Long story short, decided that village life was not for me. I was actually talking to my husband last night that I used to catch the train from my little village to London, which was like an hour and a half on the weekend when I was a teenager. God knows how I got permission from my parents to do it. And I would go to the Haagen-Dazs cafe because, you know, you couldn't get in my village Haagen-Dazs ice cream.
Oh, wow.
And so I would go to the Haagen-Dazs cafe and I would spend my money on strawberry cheesecake.
Oh my God, that is the best one.
I know, right? And I would just walk around Covent Garden imagining this life where just this feeling you can only have when you're a teenager where you're like, will my life be like this? Like, could my life be like this? Could it be city and buzz and so many different looking people and all of this energy and, you know, you're just angst basically, teenage angst.
But
so
also
I'd walk around for a while.
As well.
Yeah, you have the
same as you. I'm from a very small village as well, and I mean we were only like a 40-minute bus ride into the city. But even at that, it was like, whoa! Like it's that sense of, isn't it? You're going to be finishing up school soon, and it's that sense of like, who am I going to be? Where am I going to go?
Yeah, anything. Well, it's the sense that anything's possible, and also the question as to whether or not everything is possible or anything is possible. I mean, I remember this is a true insight into my teenage angst. I remember watching Dirty Dancing for the first time. And I watched it and I was just blown away by this love story. And I went upstairs and I took a bath. I remember it so clearly. I took a bath and I started crying in the bath because I was just thinking, will I ever have a love story like that? Like, will my life ever contain a love story? Like, does somebody living in a little village ever have a love story like that?
Oh, bless you. Well, I haven't seen Josh on the dance floor, but I would say it's a pretty special love story that you guys have.
I mean, his dance moves are memorable, definitely memorable. So fast forward, you know, I ended up going to London and living in London, and I worked for Sony, Columbia Records for a little while, and I worked for Harrods for a while in public relations, and then decided to put on a backpack and come over here. And came over here, just kind of had a few friends, but they all left very quickly. Mm. And I made this weird decision, which felt weird at the time, to stay. I just remember having this moment on the ferry when I'd got off the airplane. I caught the train to Circular Quay from the airport, got on the ferry to Manly, where I had a friend living who'd rented a room for me. And I just remember I'd only been in the country, I don't know, 15 minutes, maybe half an hour. And I was just like, I'm here.
Wow. You know,
my previous plan of getting a waitressing job, I had a ticket onto LA, which just flew out of the window. And I was like, people actually live like this.
Wow. I mean, if there's going to be a moment where you fall in love with Sydney or Australia, it's going to be sitting on a ferry going over that beautiful
ferry. Yeah.
You know, it's funny you say that because I know for me, I arrived in Australia with my English ex-boyfriend. Well, boyfriend, obviously, at the time. And we only lasted 3 months out here. I mean, we pretty much, we had traveled for 7 weeks through Brazil and Argentina on our way from the UK. Because I'm not from the UK, but I lived in London for 3 years. And then we decided to do the Australia thing. And we traveled through South America for 7 weeks on our way here. And I swear we started fighting the first day in Rio. Like the first night, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? And we arrived in Australia and it was, you know, same. But I didn't feel like Australia was home until I met Wade. It was like the minute I met him, it was like I just immediately sprung these roots, and this is where I was going to be. And funny enough, like you said, my thing was always, once I split up with the ex-boyfriend, I always thought I'd head to the States. Like I thought that would be my next destination. But once I met Wade, that's when my roots sprung. And it's interesting that yours sprung straight away, regardless of what man was in your life.
Yeah, it was very much an instant love affair with me, I think, with the city itself, with the lifestyle that was here. And yeah, I don't know, but it was a very definite moment. And then, you know, the task after that was to get a visa, was to get a job, because my previous plan had been to just be a working holiday visa and stay for a little period of time. And so I set about trying to find a job that would sponsor me. And the economy wasn't amazing at that stage. And
when are we now, hon? What age are you at this point?
Oh, I am 22.
Okay, got it. Yeah. 22.
And so I'm trying to find a job. I can find plenty of jobs, but no one's prepared to put, you know, rubber to the road and sponsor me, because it's quite expensive. It's a lot of paperwork. And you also have to prove that nobody else in Australia could do the job, which, I'm good, but I ain't that good. So I'm kind of struggling to find a job. And then I was working at Foxtel doing a contract, and this girl I had met out of nowhere just faxed me this job ad from her local Balmain paper. So it wasn't even a national paper. It was this tiny little local paper. And she said, that sounds like the kind of thing that you do. And I read it and I was like, that sounds nothing like what I do, but screw it. I'm going to apply for it. And it was for a speaker's agency. And I went for the interview.
That's what I call a God moment.
Yeah. It was me and this girl literally met. I was going up an escalator, she was going down, and we managed to have a 30-second chat. And
that
we met for lunch
God
the next
moment.
Day.
Wow. Love.
So she faxed me. This is how long ago faxed me. So she faxed me this thing. And I thought, well, why not? I'll apply. And so I applied. I met this lady, and she basically said to me, which, you know, was 100% true. She's like, well, you don't have any of the skills required to do this job, and you want more money than anybody else, because I needed to earn a certain amount to get my visa. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to my accountant, and he says no. And I've spoken to my husband, and he also recommends no. So I'm going to give you the job. She's like, but on the condition that, you know, you pay for your visa application and you fill out all the paperwork. And I was like, okay, I'll find a way to do it.
You know, that mirrors so much my first time, because I got a working holiday when I arrived in Australia as well. And very same as that, it was a small business. It was like 10 staff. And my boss was like, yeah, you just need to do the paperwork. So it's funny that I feel like there's so many mirrors in our lives, you and I.
Yeah.
But same as that, he was like, you sort it out. And I was so, I just wanted to stay in Australia because I just met Wade. And I was like, yeah, I'll make it happen. So it's funny, we both took such ownership of that.
I think that's the right word, ownership. You know, you could say that to somebody and they'd go, oh, nobody will sponsor me. You know, no one's prepared to go the yards to sponsor me. Or you can hear something else, which is, you know, I'm willing to back you, but you've got to do the hard yards.
Love that.
And, you know,
yeah.
You go, right, okay, you've just given me a shot and I will take it.
Yeah.
So worked with her, I was literally in the basement of her house, like next to the garage, and worked with her, and the business grew. You know, you know her, Leanne Christie, she's the founder of Ovation Speakers Bureau. She's,
yes,
you know, one of the smartest, most generous people in the speaking industry, definitely in Asia Pacific, probably the world. And so the business started to grow, you know, I grew with it. I was there for a few years, and then I was like, okay, you know, I started thinking about going to the States again. And I had one of those moments you can have in your mid-20s where I was like, right, that's it. I'm going to go to Peru. I'm going to live on a mountain. I need to think about my next direction. Like, I really need to sit very still with some llamas. Either people llamas or actual physical llamas, I don't mind, and think about what's coming next. And so she, with all the patience that she has, said, she's like, okay, you go to Peru, sit on your mountain. And she took out this napkin and she said, but I've had an idea for a business and I'm just going to write it down, this napkin, for you, and take the napkin with you. And so she wrote on the napkin, it was like four lines, you know, speaker management agency, first in Asia Pacific. And there was a couple of, you know, here are some projected revenue numbers. And I was way too concerned with Peru at that point. So I just took the napkin and put it in my backpack. And I went off, and I can't remember how long I was gone for, probably a couple of months. And the more I sat and thought, the more the idea of giving it a shot with her specifically seemed really appealing. And so I came back and I was like, right, let's do it. And she said, well, right, there's a table and there's a laptop and an empty database. Off you go. Wow. And so, you know, I handed over all, because I had built a business within a business. So I handed all of that business over to somebody else and started from scratch. Not only started from scratch when I look back on a business, which is one thing, but on a type of business, on a business category that did not exist at that time. No one had ever heard. I think there was two other speaker management companies in the world at that point.
Yeah. No one had ever heard. It's funny how similar our experiences. So I started the Remarkables Group, as you know, quite a while after you started that business. And same thing, like first to market business, but first to market industry as well, which is like a double whammy. Can I ask a really silly question? And I actually, purely because I don't know the answer to this. You said that you responded to the ad and that was for a speaker manager. What was the difference between what you were doing and the model that you and Leanne created together then?
It wasn't for a speaker manager. It was for a speaker's agency. So a speaker's bureau. So the difference.
Okay. Yep.
So
it.
Speakers Bureau can basically, if you need a speaker for an event, they will hear what you need and they will go out. You know, they know thousands of speakers are on their database. They're constantly, you know, watching demos, figuring it out, and they'll come back to you with here are a list of five people that I think are great. A speaker management company, which is what we built, is, you know, it's like a modeling agency. We represented. You know, 10 to 15 of the world's greatest talent from a speaking perspective.
Got it. And you built them up as talent. Okay, makes total sense.
So you
had
them responsible for the sales and marketing of their business. So in that sense, the easiest way to say it is that a speaker management agency, the speakers were my clients. And in a speakers bureau, you know, the event planner, the organization is your client.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's such a tricky model, isn't it? And I don't want to talk to, I mean, I definitely want to talk about business, but not hugely. For the form of this particular chat, but I think the challenge. So I started the Remarkables Group, which was a talent agency for social influencers, which is very, very similar to what you had done many years beforehand. But I used to really struggle with that because and same with you. You really do have two clients. You've got the brand the company who's paying the speaker to come speak, but then you've also got the speaker who is your client also, but you need both of them to make that model work. So it's almost like it's double. You've basically got two clients. That's how I used to feel. And when I was trying to kind of, I guess, manage that balance for myself, I would always say that the client was 51% the influencer and 49% the person paying them. So, I mean, did you find that a challenge as well? That kind of double-sided client idea?
I think that yes, it is challenging. And I had to get really clear really early as to who my client was. So, you know, my client was the speaker. And therefore, you know, there are times where you say no to things, no to opportunities because they're not in the best interests of that speaker or that speaker's family or that speaker's business or that speaker's goals and ambitions. Now, you could have worked really hard to create that opportunity. And, you know, you've almost done it now. You know, there's a percentage that you get of the opportunities that you create. And, you know, your job is to say no if it's not in the best interests of the person that you're serving. I think where it gets interesting is when there's, you know, you're holding two spaces, and a lot of time you can be paid to be the bad guy.
Where
you're having the client wants something and the speaker doesn't want to give it for whatever reason, it might not be appropriate. And, you know, you're the bad guy on both sides because you're trying to convince the speaker that, you know, actually this would be a good idea if you believe that it is. And you're also going back to the client and saying, look, I'm afraid the answer to that question is no. And so sometimes you're paid to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
And that takes, you know, I had to learn a certain amount of, I don't know if resilience is the right word there. I think more just separating yourself out from the message that you're delivering.
Yeah. I used to tell my team at the Remarkables Group that they needed a diploma in diplomacy, because you're essentially the diplomat. You're going between both sides, the client and the influencer. And God, I remember one time we had a blog post that one of the bloggers was putting out, and it was for sausages. It was for a supermarket brand, and it was for sausages. And she sent over her food photos and her recipe for approval by the supermarket client through via my team. And the client, the supermarket client, came back and said, "It looks like dog food." And then my team has to kind of, how do you make that sound diplomatic? Because of course you can't just have no filter. It was a diplomatic mission. I think a lot of the work that we did, and you know, it sounds like it would have been similar for you.
A lot of people have that in their role. You know, that's not unique. It's a heightened version of it. Mm-hmm. I think as you said, when you have two clients, there's a lot of people who are in a middleman position, and there's a lot of people who feel like, you know, diplomacy or managing the hearts and the minds of the people that they're there to serve, you know, is often a big part of the job. It's why leadership is so hard. You know, it's that moment when you look behind you, there is no one else there. It's you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's your job to try and bring everybody from A to B with conflicting agendas. Often, you know, there's a book that was written decades and decades ago. Somebody wrote it about US politics, and they called it a team of rivals. You know, you're managing a team of rivals. You're also managing, you know, an in-house team. You're also, so getting everybody from A to B with as many needs served and met as you can along the way takes a full stepping out. Like you have to step out from you, your mood, you know, what's going on for you right now, your agenda in that moment, not your overall agenda, because that would be not serving anybody if as the leader you let go of the overall agenda. But your agenda in that moment, you know, it's a stepping out of yourself and moving yourself to the side to take care of the greater good. Mm. And, you know, there are days when that's easy, and there are days where that's really hard. You know, those moments, and you would have had a ton of them, you know, those moments where it's like 5 to 6 and you're just about to go home and you've had one hell of a day.
And the post has to go live at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
And the phone rings, or someone knocks on your office door and says, can I talk to you? Mm. And you just think, no conversation that's ever good starts that way. Yeah. And you just look at the clock and you're like, I'm going to be here for another hour. And this is, you know, this is not going to be good. And I'm exhausted and I'm hungry. And this is the last thing that I feel like doing right now. So, you know, my emotional preference, and, you know, those are the moments where, you know, you decide to show up. Or, and this is, I got a lot better at this as my leadership journey went on. I was terrible at it at the beginnings. Or you say, I do really want to hear you. Mm. And to give you my full attention and my full, you know, intention. I can't do this in this moment. Can we make a time for tomorrow morning? Can we? So I got a lot better at that, at not showing up just because, you know, it's like looking at your phone every time a notification goes off.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a good analogy. I love that.
Attention and energy management. I got a lot better at that.
Yeah, and I think as one of my friends, as an example, I do really look at you as a great example of energy management. And yeah, massively so. Can I talk about the first time I'm actually trying to remember the first time. Oh, I do remember. Lisa Messenger, who's a very good friend of yours and a former mentor and also a friend of mine, and said to me, I think you'd really like, how did that meeting come about? So we met for coffee. You came and met me at the coffee shop near my office at the time in Surrey Hills. Did you ask Lisa to put us in touch, or did Lisa just kind of, was that an idea?
No,
that
I think I asked Lisa. I think I'd been watching what you were doing. I loved what you were doing.
Thank you.
I'd been watching you, and I was looking at collaborations at the time. I was looking at expanding the reach of the business by bringing in different collaborations. So, you know, we weren't an expert in sports, for example. So going out to talent management agencies in the sporting arena and saying, look, you know, we can represent your talent in the speaking world. We're experts at that. You're experts at what you do. Why don't we collaborate? Mm. And so the idea initially was to come to you with a collaboration and say, look, you do influencers, we do speaking. So I'm sure that many of your influencers get invited to speak. You know, maybe you can help some of my team and maybe we can help some of your team. Mm. So that was the intention. I don't know if I ever actually got to it because I think we just chatted.
I think we did chat, and I know I was just so in awe of you because when you'd first email me, or Lisa put us in touch, the first email I got from your email address, and you had your New York number at the bottom, like you had an Australian number at New York, and I was like, oh my God. I was like, you just went so high in my estimation. And I think the whole coffee meeting, I was just looking at you going, wow. You know, and can we talk about that moment, because you had built Ode, yes?
Yes.
I always get the two names mixed up. Yeah, so Ode. So it was Ovation, and then you started Ode. So you had built that to be, you know, extremely successful. You were about, I think, 8 years in at that point, maybe 7, 8 years in. And you had the New York office, so you were traveling a lot. And
so, yeah, just to correct previously, so Ovations was the speakers bureau, and then Ode became a spin-off, a sister company that was run by myself and Leanne. And Leanne was also still running Ovations, so I was the managing director of yes. Ode. At the time, we had expanded into the States, and we had a number of different speakers, and we probably had about 4 staff members, I think, dotted, you know, all around the USA. And what I, you know, talk about energy management, what I was not very good at that time was energy management. And I had always had this sense, which turned out to be wholly untrue, that I was endless. And it was just this feeling of, you know, yeah, sure, my resources are endless. You know, my energy is endless. And so delegation was not a superpower of mine. And, you know, much to the unfairness of the team, who were a group of highly, highly capable, talented individuals. And so I was jumping on and off planes, you know, building a business in the States, putting deals together, signings, you know, marketing. I would literally get up and start my phone calls at 5 a.m., sometimes earlier in the morning. I would finish at about 8. I would have a shower. I would go to the Australian office, deal with that for, you know, a whole day. And then when they went home, I would be doing, you know, the rest of the stuff that it takes to make a business work. And it was an insane period of time, And I wasn't taking very good care of myself, and I wasn't setting very good boundaries. And the more people I was responsible for, you know, even that language I was responsible for, the more people the business was responsible for, the more I used my personal energy banks to tap into that, or yes. to allow to be tapped into.
Yeah.
I didn't make smart decisions about delegation. I didn't make smart decisions. No, I tried to keep people in the business that shouldn't have been there. I also, you know, didn't pull people in that should have been there. And eventually I remember this moment, and it's so funny, I could find it. There's a photo on my phone, and I was in Indianapolis, and it was one of those moments where, you know, you've been up for 36 hours and the carpet's starting to rise off the floor. Mm. You know, those swirly hotel carpets?
Yes,
I literally do. Starting to rise and move. And I was so jet lagged. I didn't even know what time of day it was. And I went for a walk about 3 a.m. around Indianapolis, and I found a church. And, you know, I don't identify with any particular religion, but I just sat on the steps of this church, and I took a photo of myself, which is such a weird thing for me to do, but I took a photo. And the reason I took the photo was just purely for myself. I thought, I never want to feel this wretched ever again. I need to remember how this feels. I need to remember how wretched I feel at this moment, how exhausted, how confused, how overwhelmed. You know, the feeling of, you know, an absolute feeling of not being enough, of never being enough, of not being able to contribute enough, not being able to help enough, not being able to lead well enough. And I took that photo, and I said, it's still on my phone somewhere. Mm. And I got on the plane the next day. I think I went to an awards night that night, the next day. A deal we had been working on had fallen over, which had significant consequences. And I went to an awards night that night to support a friend of mine who was up for that award. And I just sat there, and I was joyless. I was absolutely joyless. And I got on the plane the next day. And, you know, I got home, I got into the I got into my house and, you know, the usual thing happened. You know, the phone rang and it was the team. And, you know, I used to call it the shit bucket. You know, here are all the things we've saved for you for when you get back that are just really hard. You know, here are all the things. Oh, here are all the people that we've said, oh, we'll get Julie to call you when she gets back.
Oh, no.
And so you're just like the list of people who are irate or, you know, situations that haven't gone well, just the shit bucket. And so, and again, that's me. You know, I don't want in any way, shape or form, you know, talk about radical self-responsibility. That's me. I had not set up the systems and the structures and the faith and the trust and the empowerment for them to feel like they could handle those situations without me.
Mm-hmm.
Or that I wouldn't pull it apart even if they tried.
Mm.
And so, you know, I dealt with those. I went to bed. I got up the next morning and I can remember so clearly. I sat down at my computer the next morning and I was trying to read an email and I couldn't. I could not read the email. I couldn't make the words make sense. They were all in the weird order. And I just stared at it. And then I got up and I went to my business partner's office and I just said, I need to go home. There's something really wrong and I need to go home. And I went home and there I stayed for probably about 8 weeks, I think, six to 8 weeks.
And so how are you physically, like, did you have, because I know Sarah Wilson, I remember she described her adrenal burnout to me once and she said, I just could not get out of bed. It's like my legs wouldn't work. How did you physically feel?
Just, I remember staring at the washing up and feeling like I could maybe manage half of it. And there's only two of us, who just had breakfast.
And you weirdos, you don't use your dishwasher. I think it's the weirdest thing in the world. And you've got two kids. I just think it's weird.
One day I will become a convert. I really believe that I will, but right now I'm totally not.
anyway.
And so I would look at the washing up and I think, okay, I can do half of this and I'll come back and I'll do the other half later. And I lay in, we had this kind of concrete back yard with lots of pot plants and I just lay on the floor and I was desperate for a way out. You know, I was Googling, I was reading, I look back now and it's a beautiful period of time in my head. It was awful at the time.
So can I ask, Jules, did you at that point, I know you went home that day, but did you have a conversation with Leanne and with the team saying, look, I need to be out for X amount of time, or did you just take it week by week? How did you do it?
It's not that I didn't find some other people might have found it differently. I didn't find it to be that tidy. You know, it wasn't that, there wasn't any clarity.
Wow.
You know, the sensation is the opposite of clarity. And so all I said was, I need to go home. And I think when I got home, you know, Leanne came with me to make sure that I could drive okay. And I think I just said, I can't do this anymore. And that was it.
Wow.
And
so how did the team cope? I've never talked to you about in detail about the kind of the logistics of this. How did the team cope?
Well, we didn't know at the time. No one knew. And I didn't know whether I was sick or we didn't know anything. I was going and I was having tests. I'd never heard of adrenal burnout. Like, I'd never, it wasn't a thing.
Well, it wasn't the cool thing back then. You know,
it wasn't. Yeah. I'd never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know what was wrong and no one knew what was wrong. And I'd gone from being able to process huge amounts of information and large amounts of dynamics and, you know, multi-layered, multi-stakeholder conversations with CEOs of banks and, you know, chief economists, not actually about economics. Let me just point that out, please. But to suddenly not being able to string a sentence together and having trouble reading a couple of lines. And so I didn't know it. And it would have been a really hard period of time for the team. And it would have been a very hard period of time for Leanne because there was no clarity.
Wow. And there how is Josh coping during all of this?
My husband. He was beautiful. He's a great person in a crisis. You know, he's very calm. That day when I came home, I just walked into the house. I don't think I even said anything, or if I did say something, it would have been, again, something very vague and non-committal and doomsday sounding. And I went upstairs and I got into bed and he just got into bed next to me.
Sweetheart.
And he just stayed there. Like just, I think I had my back to him. I think he cuddled up to my back and he just stayed there.
Did he say he saw it coming? Like, did anyone say they saw this coming?
I don't remember. I don't remember if anyone mentioned that they had seen it coming. I think I was so, you know, that beautiful Brené Brown phrase, which I think comes from, is it Harriet Langer? in the Dance of Anger, two people well worth checking out, two books, two authors well worth checking out. Talks about overfunctioning and underfunctioning. And we tend to
So I've read The Dance of Intimacy, which is one of her books.
I haven't read that one, but The Dance of Anger is amazing.
But I know the underfunctioning, overfunctioning. I know. Can you explain that just for the benefit of people who don't know what you're talking about?
I'm going to try and do justice to it. So overfunctioning and underfunctioning. Overfunctioning, Brené talks about it beautifully, actually, in a podcast that she's done recently. So if I butcher this, please go check that out. Basically, dependent on, usually it comes from family of origin, especially if you're a firstborn child or the situations that you went through. We all have a tendency to either A, overfunction in difficult times, mm-hmm. or when we feel overwhelmed or when we're anxious, or we underfunction. Now, overfunctioning is when you get controlling, you won't let anybody do anything, you won't let anybody help you. You know, you take complete charge, you override everybody, you basically, you know, go into full doing mode.
Tick, 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 tick.
Yeah,
for me.
it's a form of armor. It's basically while I am
overfunctioner.
Yeah, yes. I am. And while I am doing, I don't need to feel. You know, I don't need to feel any of the emotions that feel very, very
100%.
Unwelcome and unsafe to me right now.
Yep.
So while I am in doing mode, I am safe. And the underfunctioning, those that underfunction, it's the opposite. It's when anxiety or overwhelm hits, they retract, retreat, collapse. Often overfunctioners look at underfunctioners with that kind of, why do you make everything worse? Like, this isn't about you. Why are you making everything worse? You know, they'll create their own crisis or mini drama. And the basis of the underfunctioning is, you know, I need to be helped. You know, overfunction is I need to help, I need to control. Underfunction is I need to be helped, you know, I'm out of control. Mm. And, you know, we all have a go-to. And it's the method is different, overfunctioning and underfunctioning, but the rationale is the same. It is my go-to way of being when I'm trying not to feel what I don't want to feel, face what I don't want to face, or, you know, and I'm anxious and afraid. So, you know, total overfunction. So I don't know, in honesty, if anybody would have noticed or would have even asked.
And, you know, I had a very parallel conversation with Jack DeLosa on the last season of the podcast, and we were talking about resilience, and he was talking about how difficult 2016 had been for him because he pretty much went from 90 to, I think, 25 staff in a couple of weeks. Like, they had a huge
issue. I remember.
The business almost like very, very, very nearly went under. He had to fight tooth and nail to save it. And a lot of people said he couldn't save it, and he did. And I was talking to him about my experience of last year, and you're one of the few, I reckon you, Sarah, Wade, and my sister knew what was going on for me August, September last year, and that's it. Like, there was a very, very small group of people who knew. And we were talking about the fact that, you know, if he said to me a lot, like while we were doing the podcast interview, he said, shit, he's like, I would never have guessed. He's like, I knew things were challenging for you at the time, but I would never in a million years have guessed. And the word that he used was that things were so tectonic for you. And
oh, I love that word.
I know. How good is it? And then he said, you know, and same for me, no one knew. And probably the same for you as well, is that people just don't know because we overfunction to such, and we're so high functioning to such a degree that no one would ever guess. And it's the last thing anyone would ever think of. Shit, maybe he or she needs help because...
Yeah.
That's how we roll. Yeah.
And I think that's the MO, right? That's the MO of that state, which is I don't need anything. I don't, you know, I don't have needs, even to the point of the way that I treated my body during that period of time. Mm. You know, you guys eat. If I don't eat, that's fine. You know.
Too busy to eat. Too important to eat.
Too much stuff going on. Too needed, which is just another excuse. That's the MO of it. You know, my needs are not important. I'm here. To control and help. And
tell us, how did you get out of this?
Slowly. Mm. I wish that there was a better answer than that, but that's the truth. Slowly. I went from you know, not being able to get out of my house to being able to get out of my house. And then I went back into the business, you know, I needed to go back into the business. You know, the reality was that was needed. I think if you'd have given me a choice at the time, I would have been like, I can't. But luckily, I say that with hindsight, I'm grateful for the fact that I had to, because I think if I hadn't have got back on the horse quickly, I would have maybe forever lived in fear of the horse.
That makes sense. Yeah. And but so, ultimately you did exit that business over what, 18 months later you exited the business? Am I right?
About two, three years later.
Oh, that long. Okay.
It was a while later that I did. But yeah, it was slowly. It was bit by bit, slowly showing up when it was deeply, deeply uncomfortable and putting the pieces back together and getting better. Mm. Getting better at boundaries, getting better at delegation.
What's the biggest thing you did that contributed? Because I can imagine there's lots of different, like there's a lot of things you would have been doing with your health, for example, with the business, with your boundaries, your energy management, all of that stuff and the learning that you were doing. What do you think the biggest thing was that enabled you to get out of that kind of funk that with that health crisis essentially?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what is it? Is it a health crisis? Spiritual crisis? Is it, you know, it feels like everything combined. I think we were talking about it earlier. There's some kind of wisdom that comes with it slowly and surely and uncomfortably. That, you know, I can't control everything. And I can't put out every single fire. And even if I could twist myself into 1,000 directions enough to put out every single fire, the wiser person would let some things burn. Mm. Some things need to burn for something new to emerge. Some things need to burn because they weren't meant to be there. Some things need to burn because a lesson needs to be learned either systemically within the business or for the individual involved in creating that situation. Mm. You know, the wisdom to know when you are needed or when your energy is required and when to step back and stop fearing the burn. I think that was probably the biggest thing that helped me to move through, you know, and out to the other side. Mm. And obviously just better energy management, putting some basic stuff in place.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Now, also just to complicate the whole thing, at this point, you and Josh are actively trying for a family, yes, around this time?
Around that time,
and it's not happening. Nothing's happening.
Nothing.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
Nothing is happening. Literally, not even the foundations of that is happening.
Oh, I see. Sorry, I didn't get the levels of that. Yes.
Yeah. No, nothing is happening.
So I know in our last podcast interview, you mentioned the fact, and if anyone hasn't listened to that podcast interview you did before, I'd highly recommend you go back and listen, because I mean, this is, you know, you're offering so much gold here, but you also did in that previous episode as well. So part of the decision for you to exit the business and to walk away pretty much from the business that you had co-founded was that you said you wanted to know that you had given having a family or starting a family everything you had, and to give it essentially like a red hot go. You didn't want to look back and say, oh, maybe if I changed this or that. So do you feel like that was the biggest reason that you ultimately did walk away from that business?
I think that was definitely a very large component, wanting to give, creating a family a space. We've been trying for a number of years, nothing had happened. Mm. And I didn't want to look back and think if I had just had the courage to step out and sit in the space of not knowing what's next, then something else would arrive. But I think also that there was an element of I had done what I came to do. Now, but by no means was that finished, and by no means, you know, it had reached its pinnacle. Absolutely not. But I had created and done what I set out to do. And there was a next phase to that, you know, really kind of propelling, catapulting that US side of the business, you know, that my business partner actually ended up moving to the States and doing that.
And has made an amazing success of it, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's incredible. Yeah. And so there was a next level that was going to be involved that when I looked at it, honestly, I couldn't feel the propulsion towards it, you know? You know that whole, like, it's either a hell yes or it's a no.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not a hell yes for me. I felt in many ways complete. And when I looked at that next chapter, I was like, for whatever reasons, there's more pulling me in another direction right now.
Right. That makes total sense. And then what happened? So did you commit to IVF then straight away after leaving the business?
Yeah, we did. I think I left the business in December, and I think we started March.
Okay.
March the following year.
And you hadn't done anything at all until that point. So pretty much you went into IVF off the back of not having the business anymore.
We'd done fertility tracking, ovulation tracking. We'd pretty much done everything up until the IVF point.
Yeah.
And I remember going into the IVF clinic that first time, and they give you like this, almost this Tupperware container full of needles and things. And I was just, I couldn't talk. I was crying, but just that crying that isn't even crying. I don't know how to explain it. It's not sobbing. It's like, there's just tears running down my face, but there's no sobbing and I can't actually speak. And Josh was trying to do the talking for me. And he's like muddling through going, honey, can you just sign there? Can you just sign there? Like, babe, do you have any questions? I don't think she has any questions. He's doing his best to kind of fill in the blanks here. And I walked out and he's like, what? Like, what's going on? And I just, you know, I was just like, we're actually here, you know, like we're here. This is the last bullet now. Mm. And it's obvious, it's not, you know, there are many different roads after IVF, many, many different that we came to learn. But at the time,
I think it's the romance, isn't it? I was actually talking to one of my mentees about a recent book launch that she had, and it's almost like she told herself this very romantic story about how it was going to kind of change everything, and almost like a fairy tale, as we all do. You know, I do it with areas of my life as well. And I guess what you would have been experiencing is, and I actually remembered a very similar experience. We were trying for Lexi for a baby for a year. And we went to a friend recommended the IVF. No, they didn't actually go for IVF, but the fertility specialist who they had worked with. And we went to see this specialist. And I remember sitting there and being really, really sad. I wasn't quite, I don't think, crying, but that moment of going, oh, it's not going to happen how we thought it would, you know, just this romantic,
yeah,
have great sex. And next thing, 2 weeks later, we find out we're pregnant and hooray. And it was just almost like it coming to terms that, oh, the fairy tale may not happen.
That's so, so true. That's so true. You know, there's that moment that you hear, and you hear it all the time. You know, you go to barbecues, you go to parties, you talk to your friends. I lost track of how many of those stories you hear where it's like, oh, we had a night out, we had a bottle of champagne, we had a fabulous time. And we,
oh, you know, God, I hear you.
I don't even remember having sex. It was that fabulous. Like, the night was that fabulous. And
the sex was that fabulous. I don't remember
it. But they're like, oh, it was just one of those nights. We must have had sex. You know, it was just such a fabulous night that it all just rolls into one. And then, you know, 2 weeks later,
I just want to punch the person in the face.
2 weeks later, I pin a stick and here we are. And, you know,
and like bouncy baby in their arms.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to call it the baby unicorn. I'd be like, I would look at them and it was in my body. It was like they were describing that they just, like, oh, I just went into my lounge room and there was a baby unicorn in the corner. Like, it was that inconceivable to me that it could go like that. Like, that could be it.
I hear
that it could be 30 minutes, you know, like a few minutes of pleasure and someone would hand you a baby. Like, it was so far from my experience that I could not conceive of it.
Yeah,
literally,
yeah.
I could not conceive. And so, yeah, there's that moment of sadness. And I had always imagined, you know, I was going to get pregnant and then I was going to run the business and, you know, baby was going to be in the carrier attached to me. I was going to be getting on and off of planes. And it's had this whole thing.
Can I just touch on this as well, Jules, just on the whole idea of comparison and kind of measuring ourselves against other people? Because I know at the time you were, and I know you're still friends with Emma Isaacs, who runs Business Chicks and is like an absolute legend. But I know you at the time, Emma felt like to you and probably to me as well, when I was following, just felt like she was popping babies out left, right and center and running this incredible business and, you know, doing the whole thing. Like, I remember seeing an image of Emma and it was so inspiring to me. And she had strapped on, oh, it was her fourth baby, her little boy, whose name I cannot remember for the life of me. Ryder, sorry. So she'd strapped Ryder on and her brood of, you know, four kids were traveling. They were moving to the States because she was starting Business Chicks USA. And I remember just looking at that going, wow. And I think that's the template I had in my head, and maybe the template you would have had as well, like strapping this baby unicorn onto your chest and off you go to Indianapolis, you know, for a meeting.
I find Em and what she does and what she creates, but more importantly, how she creates it and the space she comes from during the creation process, incredibly inspiring. And that I had never questioned that it wouldn't look like that for me. You know, I'd never thought about it. I just assumed that it would look like that for me. And when it doesn't, and when you walk away from your business and in many ways at that stage, you know, your identity, and, you know, somebody hands you a Tupperware container full of needles and you think, you know, holy fuck, this it's never going to look like that. Like it's going to look like this. It's going to look like, you know, my husband, you know, stabbing me every morning with a needle. You know, that's our version of a bottle of champagne and a bonk. You know, it's going to look very different. And there's a moment of grief. There's a lot of grief that comes with that, I think. And also the thing that I really struggle with IVF, probably the thing that I struggled with the most, and I could talk about, you know, that topic at length, was there's, for somebody who, as we said, overfunctions, you know, a recovering overfunctioner.
She says, we should start a club.
Honestly, it's like, you know, when you go to AA and you have to say it every time you go because, you know, you have to choose it every day. It's like that. I have to choose not to overfunction.
I probably wouldn't get in because I'm overfunctioning too.
And so for me, I was, you know, I went into this with full gusto because looking back, you know, I was trying to avoid the pain of feeling like I had lost my identity and I had no business anymore and didn't know what I was going to do or what it was going to look like next. And so, you know, I just threw myself into this and I'm like, right.
Project for me as well, like getting pregnant was, I probably stopped just short of having a color-coded timeline to get pregnant. Like I'm
I can totally imagine that you did that. In fact, I think that you did do that and you just not everything to it.
I nearly did. I think I've come to peace with myself that I would share if I did. But yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It was a project. You exited the business and okay, next thing we're going to have this baby and that becomes your project.
Yeah. And also I had never come across anything before. All right. I'm going to stop and just be really clear in definition of this. I had never thought I had come across anything before. Now I'm a little bit wiser and I realize that that's actually a fantasy, but that I could not outthink, out-strategize, out-plan, you know, out-create, out, like, just outstand, out-show up, out-staying power. You know, I'd never come across anything that I couldn't, I'm resourceful, you know, that I couldn't create into
being. And one of mine as well is to out-charm. You know, I know that if I get my sights set on something, I know that I can outcharm someone enough to make it happen, you know, and I think Wade's the same. So it's, yeah, I hear you. Go on. Yeah, I love this.
Yeah. And you, I mean, I can definitely relate to that with the IVF nurses. You somehow in your head think that, you know, if they like me, this will work.
Yes!
It's like very not true. And by the time you've done it a few times, you well and truly lost that fallacy. And so what was I saying? Yeah. So I had never come across anything that I couldn't outthink before. And there was this thing that suddenly there's this thing that is more important to me than any other thing on the planet. And it is the only thing I have ever come across that all of my thinking, planning, strategizing, wanting, negotiating, demanding, you know, crying makes no difference to at all. None. Mm. And when I really boiled it down, what bothered me the most or what I kept getting stuck on is there's nothing for me to learn here. I feel like any other time you go through a hard situation, you look back and you think, okay, what could we learn? What can I learn? What could I have done better? How could I have been better? But with the IVF, there is nothing to learn. You know what?
Do you still believe that?
Yeah, I do, because there's a surrender to it. You know, you can take the vitamins and you can, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to support yourself, but it's my kind of very personal journey. You do those to support yourself. You know, if you're doing those because, you know, that's going to be the next golden ticket, you know, it's a road to not a whole lot of pressure on your shoulders. You know, they don't know why an embryo takes and why it doesn't take. What they do know, as much as I refuse to believe this, is it has nothing to do with how hot your bath is, or whether you ran just that little bit too fast, or whether any kind of crazy thinking that I experienced, you know, well, my bath is too hot. Oh, I'm stressed. Oh my goodness, I can't be stressed. Oh, now I'm stressing because I'm stressed.
Yeah.
Oh, that's made it even worse. You know, oh my God, did I exercise too hard? Am I not exercising enough? Oh, is that the, am I, yes. Am I relaxed? I'm not relaxed, but I'm thinking about how I'm not relaxing enough. And you know what? When they put, get yourself healthy, get yourself strong. Do those things for yourself. It's the exact same rules as parenting. Do those things for yourself and it will help your children, your future children.
Yeah.
It'll help
But don't do it because it's a golden ticket, because there isn't. When that embryo goes in, there is nothing that you can do. Something much, much bigger than you takes over at that point. And when you are somebody that wants to learn and wants to do better, for me, that was the hardest pill to swallow.
Mm. Is there any you wish you could go back? Like if you could just drop in to Jules, what, we're talking 4 years ago? Because no, 5 years ago, because Tally's four next month.
Yeah, she's four. Yeah.
Is there anything that you wish you could kind of drop back into past Julie and say to her from where you're sitting right now? And I guess what the reason I'm asking you that is for people who may be going through a similar experience, whether it's IVF or it's kind of another kind of ongoing challenge in their life. Is there something you wish you could go back and say to yourself?
That's a really good question. What would I say? I think that the only thing that you should focus on controlling is you. Is your resilience. What do you actually know? It would be this, just as I think about it more. You know, I think for a while there, I expected everybody else to take care of me. You know, I would complain that the nurses aren't being helpful enough. That, you know, they just deliver bad news and then they get off the phone like this is a conveyor belt. You know, the doctors aren't, and so on and so forth. And, you know, truthfully, as much as any other situation, you know, the only person that can take care of you is you.
Mm.
You know, you need to make decisions that work for you. You need to resource yourself up for you. You need to take a look at your resilience. And I don't mean, you know, work on your resilience. You should do that too. But take a look at your resilience. What is it that enables me to be as resilient as I can be? And for me, I think it was round three or four, I made the decision where, you know, for anyone that's been through IVF, you'll know what this is like. You're doing the physical side of it. You know, the needles, you're up to your eyeballs and beyond and hormones. You know, you're bloated, you're sore, there's invasive procedures. You know, it's the only situation in the world where somebody literally uses a dildo camcorder on you before 8 a.m. a number of mornings a week.
Oh, God.
Like, I mean, unless that's your life and you enjoy it, in which case, all's power to you, my love. All power to you. So, you know, you're bearing the full weight of the physical and emotional kind of responsibility of this. And I felt like I also had to bear the full weight of the mental responsibility. And so I took all the phone calls from the nurses. And when you do IVF, you know, eventually it becomes a day by day thing. You know, you have X many eggs. Next day, half of those eggs have now died. Now, don't even try asking why. Again, if you're me, you want to learn something, at this stage, there can be no rhyme or reason usually. Mm. And so, or at least that was my experience. And so, you know, the next day it's another phone call. These many are fertilized. The next day, half of those have disappeared. The next day. And so every day you're on this roller coaster of hope, no hope, hope, no hope, hope, no hope, which is hard enough to ride when it's the thing you want more than anything else in the world in a sane body and being, a sane, strong body and being. Trying to do it when you're jacked up on hormones, sore, sorry, and maybe this is your X amount of time of doing this. So you've got, you know, layers that have been building up. And so around about round three or four, I made the decision that I said to Josh, you know, you need to take those phone calls. I can do, which he was very willing to do. You know, I can do the physical and the emotional side of this. I can do that. I can stay strong. I can hold this and do everything else that needs to get done. But I can't hold this and then suddenly, you know, have a conversation with a technician in a lab about, you know, egg quality. And then I come off the call and then you ask me 100 questions and then I don't know the answers. I was like, I can't do that as well. Mm-hmm. And so we split. He took the phone calls and I said, okay, on the night before when you show up the next day and if you have embryos that are fertilized and they've lasted anywhere between 3 and 5 days, then, you know, you get that phone call that day or the morning to say, you know, you have this many and we'll be putting one in today if you have any at all. And so I said to him, you know, you tell me after that phone call. I don't want the build up.
Oh, wow. So you didn't get a daily update from him. You got the call. Wow.
I just want that. And I don't want to hear it from a stranger. I don't want to hear it from a nurse. I don't want to hear it from a lab technician. I want to hear it from you. And that made a massive difference. So it wasn't looking at how can I be more resilient, i.e. how can I overfunction more and just, you know, widen my capacity to overfunction. it was really, what do I need to be resilient here? How do I need to rewrite the rules of what's currently happening? What boundaries do I need to put in place?
And I love that, because I know we're talking very specifically about LVF right now, but I think we can talk about that with, I mean, anything else. I know, for example, we, and this is so different to what you're talking about, but we had a lot of issues getting Lexi's daycare subsidy, whatever it's called, set up, because
we're both CCS.
Holy shit. And I just had to say to Wade, like, I actually need you just to own that. I just need you to own it and tell me what I need to do. And I think also for men who are in relationships with women like us, and probably a lot of listeners listening as well, I think for them to actually have a job, you know, that they can actually contribute, I think that makes a huge difference.
Massively.
They can help. You know, they're actually, oh, you're finally letting me in and letting me help. So I think we are going quite deep into the IVF experience, but I think it's just a metaphor for so many other parts of our lives and other challenges that, you know, you and I are going to face as well.
How do you feel when someone you love, like when you, we've had periods where you've called and said, you know, can you help? I need some help. Can you help? Like, that moment feels amazing for the receiver, because it says so much. It says, you know, this person trusts me. Mm-hmm. You know, I am their phone call. And that says a lot for the relationship that we have. I have a chance to contribute here rather than asking myself what on earth I can do. She's actually told me, and I can do something. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much in receiving that phone call, receiving that message, that is empowering and relationship strengthening, and just stops people wandering around the wilderness wishing that they could help but not really knowing how. Yeah. And so to give that to your partner, to say, all right, this is, I can do this and I need help here. Can you please help me? Can you own that?
Sorry, go ahead. I'm getting excited.
Oh, no, I was going to say the same thing. That's an incredible gift, especially with something like IVF or children, where, you know, traditionally in a parenting sense or conception sense, you know, it sits with the mother. Mm. And, you know, we both have very capable, supportive, contributing partners. And, you know, a lot of times I know I leave Josh kind of stood there going, can you tell me what to do, because he's not that helpless, but can you make some space for me to be able to do something?
Or whatever I'm going to now go do, can it just not piss you off even more?
Yeah, exactly. Can you not redo it?
Can it not make things worse?
Yeah.
I love that. And I think just something you said there, and I guess that's exactly why this season is the season it is on the podcast, this whole idea of chicken soup conversations. I just thought about it as you said that, it just really resonated with me, that idea of being someone's phone call, like being the person that they call. And the people that I'm interviewing as part of the season, you're all my phone call, you know? And I interviewed Michelle, my business manager, who also I know works in your business as well. And Wade was with me when we found out that our little baby, that they had no heartbeat at, you know, we thought we were 12 weeks pregnant and we weren't. And Michelle was that person, because, I mean, there was obviously a functional role for that as well, because I needed her to clear my day and, you know, clear my week, as we decided to do. But I love that idea of, it's almost the idea that when particularly when you are someone who doesn't ask for help very often, and myself and Michelle actually covered something similar to this in our chat the other day when I recorded that episode with her. And it's that whole idea of that when you are the person who doesn't often ask for help, and when you do ask for help, you think that you're burdening someone else, but actually you're freeing them, because you're giving them such a gift, like you said. You're enabling them to feel that they're trusted, but also that they're needed. And I think in our modern society, I think this is what, because as we're recording this, obviously we're in full on self-isolate. We're not self-isolate. We're full ISO or social distancing mode right now with everything that's going on around the world. And I think this is what we're learning, is that it's okay to put up a hand and say, look, I do need help, but it's not actually putting a burden on someone. It's actually giving them such a beautiful gift. And that, I think when someone asks me for help, it takes me out of my own self-obsessed, narcissistic little world and enables me, gives me the gift of enabling me to be more altruistic. And that feels good. You know, that's, as humans, we like to help other people and feel that we're contributing in some way. So I love that you've said that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a real gift to give somebody, to be needed, to feel required, to feel a part of a community that's necessary.
Yeah, I love that. So thank you so much for sharing, because I know that's a it's a very, very intimate topic. And something I absolutely love about you is that you're so happy to talk about it, because I think it helps so many other people. So I know I pumped you for information. I remember arriving at Lisa's, I think Lisa had a Christmas party, and myself and Wade arrived. And it was my first time meeting Josh actually at that party. And Wade, it's funny, I don't think Wade and Josh spoke that much at that party, or if at all. And now they've got the biggest bromance in the world going. It's adorable. So it's funny how they kind of connected at a different time in you know our four relationships together. But I remember you when I saw you, and you were wearing this beautiful floaty kind of maxi dress as you're wont to wear, and you had a baby bump, and I went, oh my God, I had no idea you were pregnant. And I mean, so much had happened in your world. You'd exited the business, you were obviously, so what round was of IVF was Tali actually conceived on then?
She was in IVF, there's fresh rounds and frozen rounds. And so she was, I think I had done two fresh and two frozen, and I think she was number four. So yeah, there'd been two fresh and two frozen rounds.
Got it. And then you had your beautiful Tali, who's just, yeah, Lexi's girl hero. Adorable.
Who's currently destroying the house. I can actually hear her in the background.
Okay. literally destroying the house. So what I'd love to do, so and maybe we'll do a bit of a helicopter of kind of your remaining experience of building your family. So you guys always wanted two kids, am I right? That was always kind of the template that you were working towards.
Yeah, I mean, we had that discussion, I think. We assumed it. I don't think we had the discussion. And then I remember bringing it up probably about 6 years into our relationship or something. And he looked at me, Josh looked at me, and he was like, I'm probably going to need to think about that. And we were in Spain at the time, and he was due to fly back to Australia 5 or 6 days before me. And I had rented an apartment, you know, in the days before family, when that was possible, rented an apartment in Madrid, and I was going to stay there for another 5 or 6 days. And he was just like, well, you know, I need to think about that. And he just got on the plane. And so I spent 5 or 6 days in Madrid just going, it's over. Like, honestly, 6 years in, you need to think about it? Right. And so it was over in my head. It was done. I got back on the plane, went back into Sydney, came home and walked through the front door. And he was like, okay, yeah, I thought about it. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I was like, wow. Just a totally different brain to mine. You know, he's so literal. I genuinely need to think about it.
So similar. And I didn't really see this because I think this sounds really mean to Wade, but I feel like Josh is very nice, you know, and I think Wade can be a little bit, I think for the first time people meet him, he can be quite standoffish, because I see Wade and I see Lexi doing this actually. When he meets someone new, if I introduce someone in my world to him for the first time, I can almost see him taking a bit of a step back and deciding whether or not this person is worthy of his energy or not. Mm. And it sounds very mercenary, but he's kind of like trying to weigh them up. And if you're in with Wade, you are so in, as in your army in for life type thing. And I think when you talk about, and now I've gotten to know Josh better over the years, like I can see what you're talking about. Like they are very, very similar, like very logical. This is what you said. Okay, so that's what you mean. When I'm like, well, no, that's what I said. That's 100% obviously not what I mean. You know? Per bastards, the two.
Those are the words that I used, but that's not necessarily what I meant.
Duh.
You know, yeah, exactly. And Josh is so literal. You know, before he got on that plane, when he looked at me and he said, I need to think about it. He just meant, I just need to think about it. Like, it's a big thing. I need to think about it.
And you're like,
I heard
our whole relationship.
Yeah. I heard, I need to think about whether you are the human being I want to create a family with. I need to think about whether this is the right relationship for me.
And I need to make a plan B. If I'm not having these kids with you, well, I need to get on with the next person.
And you know, and then he just gets on the plane, and I when I got home, I was like, couldn't you have just shouldered that up a little bit? Like, I love you, you're the person I wanna be with. Let me just have a think about what our family could look like. Could you not just have softened it a little bit before literally saying the words and then walking away, getting on the tube and going to the airport?
What was the thing? He's like, Josh, I'm jumping to a different place now, but what was the thing that Josh said? Remember, you were post Ethan, I think. So Ethan is now almost one next month. So Ethan's almost one, and there was something you had put on something after, you know, your post baby, and you kind of said to him, "Look, do I look okay?" Was that post Ethan or post Tali? And what did
he
say?
It was post Tali. Oh my God, he'd kill me for this. It was post Tali. It was my first time going out after having Tali. Like, there was a
a function that we were going to.
So a sensitive moment, obviously.
Yeah, it was my first time kind of wearing anything that was not, I don't know. Yeah, tracksuit pants.
Yeah.
And you're still, you know, you're quite tender. It was pretty early. It was probably about 8 weeks. And you're still quite tender and you're very raw and, you know, very delicate. And I went into the bedroom and I got dressed and he was sat on the bed and I said to him, I was like, do I look okay? I think I said, do I look okay? Or do I look like a sack of potatoes? And those are the words that I used.
Oh, Josh, no.
And I know. See, anyone that knows Josh in this moment has just put their head in their hands and gone, oh, Josh, no. And he looked at me and he was like, because he genuinely thinks about it. These are not off the cuff responses.
Which is worse.
Which is so much worse. And he just looks at me and he's like, well, you're not exactly a swimsuit model right now.
Oh, God.
Oh, Josh. And do you know what? I didn't take it personally. I looked at him and I said, it's like, I can't even deal with that. I can't. I just don't know what to say to you in this moment. Like, it's almost compassion, the feeling. It's like, I know you and I know what your intentions are. And you just so badly fucked up that moment. I don't even know how to help you. Like, I don't know what to say to you right now.
Did he realize? Was there like a time delay in him realizing what he had said, or did it need to be pointed out, or did you even bother?
No, he looks very confused. He's like, what? You asked me. I don't understand.
Almost like a sad puppy, like going, what? What have I done wrong?
Well, it's kind of just like, I don't get it. You asked me a question, I answered honestly. Is that not what you want?
Oh,
so yeah.
Can we touch on you and Josh for a while? How long are you guys actually together? You're together longer than myself and Wade, aren't you?
We're together he was 13 years.
13 years, yeah. I knew it was longer than myself and Wade. And something I really admire about your relationship is you guys, not that you work on it, but you're quite strategic about your life together. I mean, I remember one night you were away. I can't remember where you are. And Josh, it was when you were pregnant and Josh had said, can you come babysit Tally? Because it was a work function that he had to go to in the city. And I said, yeah, of course. And I arrived over and I noticed, like, as I walked through in your house, you come in and there's like a big kind of open plan living dining kitchen. And behind the dining table, there was like butcher's paper stuck up everywhere as if you or Josh had been having like a business brainstorm. And I just kind of put it, like, Tally was already in bed. So I just went and sat on the sofa and made tea and kind of did whatever I was doing. And I think I watched a show on my laptop or whatever I was doing. And I know you said to me later, oh my God, I can't believe, like, Josh didn't take down. Like, that was, I think that was all, like, I didn't even look at it. I didn't even pass any heed, but it was like all of your financial planning on the wall. And I can't believe you left that up for Lorraine to see it. And he was like, what? What's the problem? And I, as I said, I didn't even pay any heed at all to what it was. Kind of just normal going in, and there was like stuff stuck up in your house. But I do think
there's so much stuff stuck up on the wall right now.
Like, you create the space to talk. But I know we were meant to have our village ladies catch up online last week, and you said, look, I can't make it. There was no diary. It wasn't in the calendar. And you said, I totally forgot about it. And I need to sit down and work out some financial stuff with Josh. And I just love that you guys really create that space to kind of talk and have those conversations, because let's be real, they're not easy conversations to have a lot of the time. Mm. Do you have any kind of insight as to how do you guys make that work so well?
Oh, I don't know that we always do. I think the most important part of what you just said is that we make the space for it. Sometimes it goes well. Sometimes it doesn't go well. Sometimes it involves somebody giving themselves an intervention and walking around the block five times.
What did you say the other night? You just put yourself to bed early. You said to Josh, yeah, I just put myself to bed early and giving myself a talking to. It was ISO life. You just had a tough day.
I had to go and give myself an intervention. One of the things that we did do that as a tool has served us really, really well was very early on in our relationship. I remember this moment where, you know, he's an overfunctioner as well. And so he, you know, he's going. It's very easy just to assume that Josh is fine, you know?
Same with Wade. And they kind of internalize it all. You don't know what's going on.
Yeah. And there was this moment where it was a Sunday and I walked into the bedroom and he was sat on the bed. And I said to him, it was just a very off the cuff remark. I think I just said, oh, hey, you okay? And he burst into tears. And I remember being so shocked. Like, I
had no idea anything was going on for him. I had not seen that coming. I did not know where it came from. And it really shook me, because I thought, how can I be this close to this individual? Literally side by side with him every day. And for him to be feeling that lost or overwhelmed, and for me to have no idea.
Mm.
Like, how can that be possible? I can't allow that to be possible. And, you know, for me, it's always very obvious where I'm at. I'm like, ask me, I will tell you. And, you know, if you ask me and I don't tell you, then, you know, obviously it's not a space where it's appropriate. And there's always, you know, there are those people in your life, your first phone call people, where, mm-hmm. you know, when you're at an event and you think, or you're out and about and everybody asks you how you are. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. And then one of those first phone call people asks you, and you can see them coming, and you just, like, with your eyes, you know, you're like beaming at them with laser beam eyes. Like, don't you dare ask me. Like,
you know, you'll cry. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I can answer everybody. Don't you ask me. Cause that will be the beginning of the end if you ask me. And so, but Josh isn't like that, and he internalizes. And so we put into place this system, and we've done it ever since. We've done it every Sunday for probably 12 years now. And it's a very simple system. So on a Sunday, we mark each other out of 10 for health. We mark each other out of 10. Oh, well, as in, we mark ourselves, sorry. We mark ourselves out of 10 for health.
Josh, you are not looking healthy.
Yeah. We mark ourselves out of 10 for happiness. We mark ourselves out of 10 for mojo, which is kind of just passion, energy. And we mark ourselves out of 10 for connection, as in how connected we feel to each other. And then we do one appreciation and one request for support. And we do that. Usually it takes him about 8 minutes to get through that. It takes me about 80 minutes to get through that. I just see him. I mean, every time we're like, okay, we're going to check in. Yeah, we're going to check in. He's like, you first. Like, basically, mine will be quick.
Makes a cup of tea.
Yeah, go on. So, but that, I don't know how we would have got through many of the things that we have got through, because as we said before we started recording, you know, you don't get to choose whether or not you do hard things, or whether or not you have to go through hard situations or have to have hard conversations. You don't get to choose whether or not that happens, but you do get to choose who you do it with and how you do it. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, he is absolutely my right person to do it with. And I still don't know if we could have done it unless we had had that regular check-in. If we had not have had that regular check-in.
So powerful. I love it. And, you know, I know you've touched on that before, and we've kind of tried to create our own version a few times, but I think the beauty of what you're talking about is the consistency. Like, it happens every damn week, and that's it. You know, it's not a kind of a nice to have, or yay, we did it this week. It's like, it just has to happen. So I think I know that's something I want to take back into from this chat. It's something I do want to do with Wade, you know, actually kick it into action and make it consistent this time. And now I know we need to wrap up very soon. I want to ask you quickly, how are you coping with ISO life? Because we're 3 weeks in, you and I. How are you feeling? How are you going?
How am I going? I'm probably, I think I said to you before, I'm probably like a 4 out of 5 day going strong, and 1 out of 5 day just not doing well. I think I'm, you know, we're pretty strong, we're going well, you've got 2 kids under 3 in a house with 2 business owners, you know, it's fairly intense, and it's also beautiful. You know, I was saying to someone, the best thing is I get to spend so much time with my kids. The worst thing is I get to spend so much time with my kids.
Yes! And that's you know, the thing, isn't it? And I'm operating in these kind of, almost like opposite ends of the spectrum. Like, myself and Lexi are so close. Like, she's fallen asleep on me a few times. Like, we're very... like, we're genuinely quite affectionate, her and I together, but even more so now, which is amazing. But at the same time, like, I've started yelling at her, which I've never, ever, ever done. Like, I've always been able to keep my shit. But if she's up at 6 a.m., like, landing on my lap, and I'm in the middle of my meditation, and like, and I'm not saying I yell at her all day, but I mean, I would say 3 days out of 7 this week, I've yelled, like, Lexi, just stop it. And I've never done that before. So I totally hear you on that. And thank you for sharing that so honestly.
Last night, I mean, to share one of the moments, last night I thought, we'll do homemade pizzas, that'll be fun. And hilariously, I even thought, we'll call grandma and she can watch us doing homemade pizzas, and that way she feels included and connected, and this is a beautiful moment, and Tali's really excited. It took 40 seconds to unravel. Oh, in gosh. The time I said, hey, grandma, look, we're making homemade pizzas. Shit had just unraveled. the ham did not line up perfectly. The tomato was not symmetrical. She just has an epic meltdown. And then I just lost it. I'd had all day and she'd been, you know, she's bored and she's frustrated and she's confused as to what's happening right now. She's not running out the energy she would usually run out. And so she's kind of been pushing boundaries all day. And that was just kind of the last straw for me, this nice thing that I had done to end our day on a good note. And within 40 seconds, the ham isn't symmetrical. And I was just like, right, I'm putting it in the bin. And so grandma, who's not even my mom, it's my husband's mom, is like watching. Like she's only been on the phone less than a minute now, and she's watching her entire family unravel over a pizza. Everybody's crying. Like, I don't know what she thought was happening. I was ropeable. I was obviously, had gone into an insane patch.
I'm crying laughing. Did you put the pizza in the bin?
No, because then she just went full hysterical. And she's hysterical. I am just livid, angry. And I looked at the phone. And again, she's been on the phone for less than a minute by this stage. And I looked at the phone and I was like, Grandma, we're going to call you back.
Grandma doesn't need to see this.
No, well, she's already seen it. She doesn't need to see where it's going to go from here. And so I think just trying to, you know, I always try and take those moments as an opportunity to, because how else can you take them? An opportunity to model apologizing. You know, an opportunity to model self-responsibility.
A lot of apologizing to Lexi this week.
Yeah, but also just it's okay, you know, it's okay. As a friend of mine said, you know, to me this week, she said, you know what, our children need to see us messy. You know, it's part of their development to see us messy. Pardon?
Did Jesse say that? Which friend
was
that?
It was Jesse. Yeah,
sounds like a very Jesse thing to say.
Yeah, it was a Jesse thing. And, you know, another one of my first phone calls. And she was like, they need to see us messy. How are they going to handle messy if they don't see you do messy? How are they going to handle high intensity if they don't see you do it?
Mm.
How are they going to talk themselves back off a ledge if they don't see you do it? So, you know, I've really been trying to carry that with me.
That's really powerful. Thank you. I think that's a gift for all of the people at home with the children right now as well. And very quick question, because I know we need to wrap up. Why do you think our relationship works? Big assumption, my aunt, clearly.
It would be so funny if I was just like, does it?
Really?
Why do I think it works? I think, you know, you sent me that question beforehand and I thought about it for all of about 30 seconds. And what came to me, I literally wrote it down, it's in front of me. And what flowed out of me was, it's a zero expectation relationship, which I really appreciate in this phase of my life. There's no expectations. I can talk to you every day for a week. I cannot talk to you for 4 or 5 weeks. I wrote zero expectation, just a safe place to land.
Oh, I love that. And you know, you're so right, because you're one of the few friends, when I think about it, the only friend that I would say, if you sent me a text, and I mean, you sent me a text 2 days ago asking me a question and I didn't get back to you. And we had a kind of our village ladies catch up that night. But you're one of the only, I think the only friend that I don't feel like I need to say sorry for the delay in getting back to you. Like, you just get it.
Yeah.
And I get it from your end. So yeah, that's so true. I never put that lens on it.
And there's so many expectations, you know, and I think as I get older, I shy away a little bit from relationships that have very high expectation. Not that I don't want a beautiful relationship, and not that I don't want, and I won't show up for, you know, going the hard yards with somebody and being there. But if there's a set of rules that I have to integrate into my life, along with every other set of rules, along with, you know, all the other expectations and needs, it just starts to feel very heavy. And quite frankly, I can't, in this phase of my life, I can't live up to them. I can do my very, very best, but, you know, I can't live up to everybody's every expectation of when and how I should communicate and for how long and how frequently and within what time frame.
And I'm glad you feel like that, because I 100% feel like that. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that about our relationship. I think that there's, you know, there is zero expectation, but it never feels anything other than a safe place to land.
Thank you. And you know, you are definitely on the first phone call list. And I think for me, if I was to kind of answer my own question, I think it's just the fact that we can dive deep so quickly and it's okay. And it's actually exactly what you said. It's a safe place. Like, I feel like I can dive deep and just be really honest, like myself and Wade are having a really shit time. Or, you know, last year I was diagnosed with situational depression. And I remember talking to you, I was driving, I was taking Lexi home from daycare and I had you on speaker and I told you that. And it was just, you didn't skip a beat, like not a beat. You're like, okay. You know, there's acceptance. I think that's what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I can remember phoning you during a period of time where you were having a really hard time. And I can't remember whether it was Josh who said, you know, I think you should call Lorraine, which obviously indicated that maybe Wade had said, or how it came about.
Oh, do you know how it came about? Wade asked you to call me because he was away. Remember, he was in the States and yeah, he actually was so worried that he said, like, can you actually please call Lorraine because I'm worried about yeah, her. That's what happened.
I remember actually, yeah, it was a voicemail and a text message and he said, can you please call Lorraine? Mm. And again, I was so grateful to be in a position that I was trusted enough to make that phone call.
Mm.
Or to, you know, that somebody believed, that Wade believed that I could be of assistance. And I remember saying to Josh, I was so serious about it. I was like, Josh, Lorraine needs me. So, you've got the kids. I need quiet space. I'm going to be in the bedroom and no interruptions. And you need to do dinner.
I can almost see you sitting there with your clipboard, like, I'm going in. That's it. Hard hat.
Yeah, it was just like, Lorraine needs me. I'm in. I will be back when I am back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I was probably driving Lexi home from daycare and she had a shit fit. So I was like, sorry, I have to go.
Honestly, that's most parenting phone calls, right? You're like, hey, how are you? I'm really good. Oh, no, don't get up. I've got to go. Like, that's how most phone calls go.
Oh, my love, I could sit here and talk to you for hours, as you know, but I need to let you get back to your day. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you feel like we want to cover? Obviously, I need to say that you've got an incredible podcast called Inside Influence. I did get that right, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Yes, yeah. Inside Influence. And yeah, you're kind of cooking away because obviously your business has been changed right now because a lot of what you do is being an incredible speaker. So yeah, I think following you on Instagram, and also I think you're very active on LinkedIn as well, would be the best place to find you. But is there anything else that you feel you wanted to cover before we go?
No, I don't think so. It's lovely to have a space, and just massive kudos to you, honey, for creating a space where, you know, conversations can be had. And obviously, you know, by the amount of downloads that you get and the incredible community you've built, these, you know, conversations are very, very needed. And it's the hardest kind of conversations to have, you know. You can talk business and concepts and tools and skills and, you know, all of those things are very important. But, you know, I think the world needs more of these kind of conversations right now.
Oh, thank you. Chicken soup conversations, as I'm calling them.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much again for joining me. And yeah, I'll probably talk to you like tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll probably either that or not for, you know, 6 weeks. Well, yeah, either is fine.
Thank you. So there you have it, my magical, wise, incredibly smart friend, Julie Masters. I am so glad you could join myself and Julie in our chat today. To connect with Julie, you can go to juliemasters.com, which is her website, obviously, or you can find her on Instagram at jules.masters. So thank you so much again for joining me this week, and I cannot wait to bring you another chicken soup conversation next week. Sending you much, much love today. Thank you for being part of this week's episode. It was remarkable to have you. I am always keen to hear your thoughts, questions, ideas, and suggestions for future topics for the podcast. So please get in touch on Instagram. My handle is at Lorraine Remarks, and through my website, lorrainemurphy.com.au. If you're enjoying what I'm putting out here, please do rate, review, or subscribe to the podcast so more people can find out about it and we can build this special community. Or even better, do all three. Chat to you next week.